Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Scales of Truth, a sports Scales of Truth for you. This is Tyson Harley. Kind of a later Game 3 Finals reaction slash implied Game 4 prep. But yeah, interesting as a Spurs fan, we did at least get one. Let's start with this. We'll do game flow later and then just my general impressions as far as strategy. First of all, this is the big boys now, okay? I thought this at first, at about first or second quarter of game one. Then the Knicks showed them who's boss and really came back in that. But now through three games, you got to realize it's anybody's three games, really. I mean, this is a heavyweight fight, even if one is the more inexperienced fighter, because all of these games came down to crunch time. Spurs had a lead under two, I believe, in game one. Spurs were tied with the ball with about 12 seconds left in game two. So anybody could have a 3-0 lead. Game three, the Knicks had every chance to steal that back, if you will. Over three games, Knicks by 5 total points. As a comparison, as you know, from the big victory streak, but still interesting, through three games of the previous three series, against the Cavs, Knicks were plus 40. Against Philly, because they are who we thought they were, honestly, the Knicks were up 59. In Atlanta, granted, before the Knicks caught fire, but even then, as they went down 1-2, they were still plus 8. So now let's go to game flow. So right away, Spurs get up, start quick, get up 30-20. After one, they're up 33-22, up by a dozen early in the second quarter. Even at 9:20, they're still up by 10 in the second quarter. Then it's soon just 7 with 8:42 left. And then it's only 42-38 at 6:48 left in the half when Wimby goes out. So a 4-point lead. And when Wimby comes back in, it's actually still a 4-point lead, so they held that pretty well. But nonetheless, Knicks do take a first lead at 50-49. So as a Spurs fan, you're thinking, uh-oh, here comes the onslaught where we lose everything we got in the second quarter. And in fact, I think this is another first quarter 30-point quarter by the Spurs. So we see this at Knicks taking a lead at 50-49 at 4:17, but not as bad as it could be, honestly. Wimby gets it back with a three. You got 52-50 San Antonio with 3:30 to go. It's tied at 54 with 2:37, and it's even 56-44 San Antonio, and then eventually tied 56-56, and then it's 57-56 San Antonio at 1:37. But then it's just kind of unanswered from there. 59-57 New York at 109, 62-57 at 42.5, 64-57 at half. So second half, while the Spurs don't get, well, they do get blasted pretty big. They're just lucky that they got they're lucky that they had a good first quarter. But I got to say, where the Knicks took the lead, the Spurs kind of fought back into it. But yeah, otherwise it could have been worse the way it flowed. But the Knicks scored 42 and outscored San Antonio by 18 in the second quarter. New York, really, though, in the second half, they didn't help themselves. They had a bad couple of turnovers, I think, immediately in the second half. And then there was a flagrant on a closeout by Brunson on Champagne, landing zone reckless. So 64-63, New York in well under 2 minutes, though, into second half due to the free throw after they did have a 7-point lead. You get to, let's see, where else would I like to say? Spurs take a lead 72-71 at about 7:20 to go. But then it kind of fight back and forth. You got 73-72 Knicks and 76-72 Knicks. Back to tied at 76. With only 5 minutes to go in the third. And then you get 79-76 in the third. Brunson gets four fouls with 4:29 left in the third. And that's at the same time that Wimby goes out. I forget if that's when Brunson went out or not. But Wimby goes out with 80 to 78, and that Spurs with 4:29 left in the third. And it ends with 92-91, I believe. Hold on just a second. Yeah. Harper answers with a three after a Clarkson three to get it to 92-89 in the third. And then Knicks do something to make it a two-point game after three. But the big thing was that was a humongous rest by Wimby, because I believe he was out since 4:29. So the Knicks start out with Brunson on the bench in the fourth, probably thinking, you know, he's our microwave late in the fourth. He is clutch time. So as long as we can stay close, you know, we'll be all right. Okay, we'll be all right. But something that happens is that New York gets a lot of fouls early in the fourth quarter, just like they, I believe they got a lot of quick fouls. Well, they did, but I don't remember. I believe they went to bonus pretty quickly in the third quarter. And they got three fouls early, which didn't put them in bonus super early, but it came not before long. And so while it was 92-91 after three, in the fourth quarter with these fouls, the Spurs get an opportunity. It's still 96-91. The Spurs had not scored when Brunson comes back in, almost 3 minutes in. Okay. And then when they finally do score, it's 98-93. There's an interesting situation where it's almost a 10 or 11 point lead at 100-93 when Wimby gets fouled on the three, but then they realize it's a good challenge. Keldon Johnson did push him, Mitchell in the back, the defender. So they take that away because it would have been a three-point and possibly a four-point play. Because Wimby made that three-point play. So that's off the ball. So instead, it's just a seven-point lead, and then immediately Brunson gets them to five. So humongous turnaround at about 7:36, 95-100. Suddenly, what would have been an 11-point lead is only a five-point lead. Spurs fans are bracing for it. The New York Knicks fans are hoping for it. And then there's a challenge on a hold for an offensive rebound out of bounds on Wimby, with Cat reaching up and around Wimby's upper arm. It's one of those proximate foul challenges. And so you get the free throws, and the Spurs get it to a seven-point lead again at 7:12. Now, this is interesting because at 7:12, Wimby has 28 points of his 32, so he only gets four more the rest of the way. So now come clutch time, 5 minutes to go. You know, I mean, I guess, is it not technically clutch time? Do they call that within 5 points in 5 minutes? Nonetheless, at five-minute point, it is a six-point lead. And so it's Brunson time, baby. It's Brunson burner time, right? And luckily, at that moment, we're just going to look, you know, it's Brunson time. Brunson immediately turns it over as he brings the ball up the court. Wimby only gets 2 points in clutch time because, well, hold on, he might get one more. I forget. I think he got two more points somewhere just outside of clutch time. But he does get an effective 2 points in clutch time in that in under 5 minutes, he draws a foul to get it to 108-100. Granted, with still 4:50 to go, but kind of a timely 2 points if you're only going to get 4 points the rest of the way after that six-ish or whatever that was that I told you he got his 28th point. And also then with four to play, Wimby gets a big recovery block on a Shamet drive from the corner to keep it 108-100. So that was pretty big. Things just stay tight. Still at 108-102. So now we're down to 6 point lead with 3:37 to go. Fox has his fall down and turns the ball over. Cat misses a three, a pretty good wide open three for a good 3 point shooter. And so that still keeps it tight. Castle blocks on a Brunson drive, if you recall. And then the ball stays live near the baseline. And Cat gets it. But Fox has a clean block on Cat from behind. So a little bit of that whole New York and Chicago type of a feel. Multiple blocks down low for the Knicks in a big-time playoff game. Though, of course, that wasn't against Mr. Inevitable Jordan and his Bulls, but still had a little bit of a feeling of that. So then right after that, the Knicks are getting this. Okay, they've had the Brunson drive. He gets blocked. Cat gets a chance. He gets blocked, but it goes out of bounds. Inbound play to Cat right at the rim. He gets blocked out of bounds again. We don't see the replay, but Brunson gets a quick mid-range right out of his out-of-bounds play, gets a little bit of screen on the way out, nice little shorter mid-range in the just outside of the paint or just inside the paint, and all of a sudden it's 108-104 with 2:20 to go. And then we get it to 11, the Spurs get it 111-104 with 148, and a bunch of things happen. You're going, can we hold on as a Spurs fan to this 7-point lead? And it's still holding at 104. And then OG does what he's doing. He's really woken up. And he gets fouled by Wimby at the rim. And I think maybe what brought him to... Oh, never mind that. OG fouled by Wimby at the rim in transition for free throws at 59.6. And so he does miss one, but now we're talking just a 6-point deficit under a minute. And immediately then, or soon enough, next possession that they have, Brunson cans a three at 33 seconds left. So we are right in Brunson burner. Oh, crap. Let's not give up this lead. This looks like a lot like game two. This looks like a lot like game one. This is potentially an 0-3 hole. Brunson's burning, and it's 111-108 with 33 seconds left. And then we get a big, big mid-range from just short of the free throw line by Fox to the Spurs for a 113-108 with 12.2 seconds left. Not a big game by Fox, but sometimes timely. New York uses a timeout to advance, though, and OG immediately makes a corner three right off of a great inbounds pass from Josh Hart. So we're talking 113-111. I mean, this is another instant classic, honestly. 9.4 left. A beautiful inbounds pass from Hart. OG cans it. So we're talking a 2-point game with 9.4 left. We are now saying, well, you can't play defense, so what are you going to do? They have to foul. They foul Castle. He's just second-year guy. He cans both of them to get it back to 4-point. And that's it, boys. So, again, down by 7 at half. The third quarter is the first time this series that the Spurs have scored 30 in a quarter other than the first quarter. It's their first third quarter win and their first second half win. Now, another way of looking at this is that the Knicks were 57-40 versus the Spurs in total points in the second half of game one. They were the Spurs did beat them 52-49 in the second half of game two. They showed some life, but they still couldn't quite get it done and allowed that big Spurs lead that they had to come back from. And so 58-47 Spurs second half of game three is a continued improvement as a general trend line, if you'd like. If you want to feel a little bit dread, if you're Knicks fans, as opposed to feeling purely positive. So that's good. Scoring droughts, we had not as big of a scoring drought in game three for a quarter. The lowest quarter in game three was 23 points, which was quarter four. In game two, we had only 18. That was in quarter two. And in game one, we had only 19 in quarter four. So better at finding consistent scoring. Another interesting thing from the Spurs, they were 10 of 10 in the fourth quarter in free throws. So that was really big. Another interesting thing, I'll point out others, but this is high-level stats. Turnovers, the Spurs only 8 turnovers in this game 3. They had 16 last game. Remember, as I say, we watch the growth in front of this. I know it's not quite the same defense, but it's a good defense. Remember, Castle was committing 20 turnovers himself in individual games. Now, true, that's when Fox wasn't as available, but it still gives you something to compare. Only 8 turnovers for the team entirely, 13 for the Knicks, which isn't awful, but, you know, that exceptional 21-7 turnover margin, rather points off turnover margins, favoring the Spurs. Another thing we saw, more D-Harp. You know, a lot of people are like, well, you know, the thing is, Fox is a veteran. He does bring that stability, but he's not always showing anything except timeliness. And I agree with that. I think D-Harp has at least earned the benefit of the doubt to be the primary ball handler. And for Fox to see a little bit less of the floor, I think they even played a 3-guard lineup at times. So D-Harp played 32 minutes and, you know, as primary ball handler, some just as that second lineup when Wimby was out. So Wimby not on Cat, I thought this was important. Other people have pointed it out, but in watching the full game, and this is why I have a more of a reaction episode here, because I did rewatch the whole game. And so I rewatched the whole game after I heard some of what other people have said, like just generally any podcast you might listen to, articles you might read, going over to Pounding the Rock, which is a Spurs site. So I grant them, I may have observed this, but grant them some credit for maybe helping me observe this. Because when I do observe, I try to go, what do I tend not to observe? I don't tend to observe what our guys defensively are doing in detail. But because I did re-watch, I was more likely to observe that. But I may have been more likely to observe it just because somebody else also said it. But Wimby not on Cat, I agree with other commentators that this was big. Shoot, they even put Fox on Cat at times. Okay, so I don't know if we're surprised or not, you know, but this is big, and can it be effective for more than one game becomes interesting. I think it's clearly a good move because he did not go nuclear at all with everybody else guarding him, including someone smaller like Fox. You know, we've got some heft with Champagne, with Vassell on him, and I think it worked. I really liked it. And it allowed Wimby defensively, what he was doing a lot of times, is not worry about a singular offensive player. You'd see him hanging kind of on the baseline at the edge of the lane, and he could kind of stay detached from that corner three offensive player. And he kind of from there could react to play two positions. You know, he could play if somebody gets into the lane, so people had to worry about him there. And if it looked early that someone had cut somebody off, he could still react out to the three a little bit. And again, you don't so much block threes as maybe disturb him with getting into sight lines. So I thought that was smart. As a lot of the Spurs wings do at least have that good heft. And I think Cat really loves attacking bigs. I think he likes attacking bigs. He knows he's got the quickness advantage on bigs. He doesn't necessarily have that confidence in his quickness over guards. There was a perfect example where he started to drive past Carter Bryant. He couldn't get all the way past him, so he stops and sprays. And that's not bad. It's not a bad play. I can't remember if the guy made the three, but there's nothing wrong with your big guy or anybody, you know, getting a good drive and spraying out to the three. I'm just saying as an example of how Cat likes to burn with his quickness the centers and the big guys, I think it might be a good play. I like it, but again, everything looks good when you've won, right? But overall, I do think that it allowed Wimby to be more generally available, you know, down low. I think that makes sense when he's worried about guarding the three. Then Cat can bring him out, and you're allowing them to dictate where a Wimby is defensively. And I like this a lot better. Okay, Castle was big, as everybody knows. Sorry, I almost had one of those pause because of my voice moments. Going to do that now. Yeah, obviously Castle was big, but let's talk about it. Only 14 points in Game 2. Game 3, very efficient, 8 of 14, 2 of 5 at 3. Really timely in that fourth quarter. 5 of 6 at line, super solid for 23 total. He and Wimby, you may have seen in the scroll, first teammates in a finals game with 20 or more points. Also, what I love about Castle, people talk about him, but this is so true. Not only just his kind of his patience as he gets into the paint and his shiftiness, kind of that almost skip and jump over to another spot as he sees the leverage somebody has on him down low. He just skips right real quick if they're too far left and gets off that that layup. To me, this is a better example of that. So Castle's up on the upper right. He's driving from kind of that three-quarter to the right area. I forget how far in, but he does drive. He gets Hart on skates a little bit. He gets to his left, and then Hart grabs his right forearm as he's kind of skipped to the looing past him. No foul is called, but it is a foul. But Castle focuses on the ball because he loses the ball because Josh is pulling down his forearm. And you see the ball kind of pop up in the air, and he could have just like give up and overreact right then and flop his dreads and everything. Instead, he focuses on that ball that's kind of going up into the air, and he regathers it and makes a layup. And after that, he goes, foul, man, foul. And I forget what they do there, whether they do a challenge or what, but it does get called. But I love that instead of just stopping because he's waiting for the foul to be called, he followed it through. And that's exactly what Jordan did, right? Like, if you foul him, you foul him, but he's going to try to make the basket. That's when people, you know, love hope for the older game. They're like, can you please just not act like somebody just blew you up? It's a foul, it'll get called. And this is what they really love about the NBA game now. The truth of the NBA game is that proximate foul is a really good rule change. As reactionary as the referees are, and they miss fouls that are obvious, and they call fouls that are not fouls, that there's a proximate foul, and so that you can not just be limited to, no, you didn't get, you know, it was it just some standard of review? You're like, well, I mean, they called it, then unless it's egregious, we don't turn it back. You know, I really like this rule change. The hugathon continues for Cat on Wimby, and on Bridges, we had a little do-si-do where, grab your partner, do-si-do, kind of. So Bridges tries to stop a advantage by Wimby for an offensive rebound and just tries to hold him down via the I-heart treatment early in an included in early fourth quarter foul. And so they don't like it, you know, but I Hart/Bridges is definitely holding him down. I can't remember if I said this earlier, but one-on-one versus Brunson clearly is the way to go. It just is. That way the other guys who are good defenders can stay on their guys. You know, Wimby, others can help if they need to, but there's just don't rush Brunson. I mean, think about it. Think about it in clutch time. But to me, so far, this adjustment of going one-on-ones, one-on-one with your physical play. But, you know, we'll find out. I mean, that's going to rely on this physical defense. So we'll see come game four if it's called the same way. Can we go to the subject of Wimby temper? Yeah, Wimby's going to have to be careful. He has those little temperature explodes. His play on Jaylen. Now, I understand that in some sense, This is the type of shuck away play when people are bothering you as a big guy, like these guys are getting in on me. But you got to remember where you are versus Brunson. That ended up being a push at the top of his neck and his head. So against a bigger guy, yeah, you try to push away a little bit, but you got to be careful of the visuals of the little guy. And I don't know, I haven't looked. Some people have thought that should end up being a flagrant. But yeah, I get it, they're into your body, you know, down low. You're tired of little guys getting into your body down low. But you got to remember, you are bigger and stronger than you used to be. You are 235. You are 15 inches taller, maybe 18 inches taller, 16 inches taller, 17 inches taller than Jalen Brunson. And you've got the leverage. Your leverage is just different, both against that smaller player and at your weight. So, yeah, you think you're shucking somebody low, but it's still at Jalen's head. So be careful. I do like the nasty of him kind of laughing afterwards, but he does need to be careful about that, only in the sense of not getting flagrants called. So he'll have to learn how to rein that in. But let's just put it on a timeline. Wimby will be hated no later than next year. That's just how we go now. The hate fuse is very, very short in 2026 and beyond. Very quickly, Wimby still gives poor picks, but I love an adjustment that they made. We'll get to that. But first, let's talk about a poor pick. What I'll call the poor pick is when the guards are going laterally. So a perfect example is Wimby, quote, sets a pick in the first quarter about two strides away. And because it's so far away, he doesn't wait to set the pick right where the guard is. You know, typically the guard can dribble in place, and then the guy who's picking just moseys up right next to the guy who's guarding him. And instead, Wimby sets his pick two strides away, and not a great idea for a pick. And so because he set it two strides away, OG gets a chance to knock out the ball from Fox before Wimby's pick has really created much traffic at all. But on the other hand, there's one regular pick that worked. I'll say that, but regular. And there's another whole design of picks that were glorious. A glorious adjustment. A glorious adjustment. And the reason it was a glorious adjustment is it's one of the main ways that that was the adjustment so that Wimby could get some action down low as opposed to always starting up high. But before we do that, a pick, if you will, a lateral pick that worked. This is really nice. I like this. Wimby was already stationary about 30 degrees off a straightaway at the perimeter to the right. And all of a sudden, Fox from close to right corner, but not quite the corner three, just starts sprinting with Brunson on him. He's still 4 feet away from where Wimby is. But because Wimby sets such crap picks and doesn't get close to the guard to set them while he has the defender right on him, instead Fox can control how close the guard has to run against this pick. And so Fox is sprinting like he looks so much better. We are so lucky about the way he's healing. And he just sprints like 7-10 feet towards the pick, which is stationary. So from his right to left, Wimby is already stationary. And we're picking on Brunson here, which we did a little bit better job of. And so he allows himself to set a sprinting towards Wimby, who's stationary pick. Brunson is absolutely picked off of it. And because of that, then Fox can turn the corner, and then with that, Wimby makes a quick curl into the paint, which is not the big deal. He may get it. I forgot if he did get the pass from Fox then, and then he sprays it out to Carter for a three. I really like that type of a pick because I've said previously our ball movement was good in game two, but it's like they weren't trying to get anybody the ball easier, like away from traffic. It's just that the ball would move around the perimeter a lot, and then eventually someone would take off into the paint, which we're very good at,
But why not try to give them an advantage with that screen? All right. Another really good pick, but this was when the second unit is was in. And when the second unit is effective, one thing that you can see is when Cornette, who is much better at screening picking, not great at the roll, but good at picking, he does go over and, okay, you got the ball, wait for it, timing, set there, wait for me to stand here, okay, I'm here, now move. Okay, he's much better at that. He sets it solid. He doesn't try to leave early. And this is an even more interesting one. I loved this. This time, Luke sets a really solid pick, but in this cool version, he gets the ball before he sets the pick. So this is another one where the big guy is setting the pick, but it's the guy who's going to get the pick and roll and get come right off of him and then scream toward the basket is not right there. So Cornette is not setting the pick right next to the ball handler. He is setting a pick from a ball handler like that's 4 feet away. He's off to the left, close to the three-point line, is the ball handler. I forget who it is. May have been it was Harper, I think. Yeah, it was Harper. Harper's closer to the three-point line. Luke is well in towards the paint. But he stands there. And then Harper basically runs his guy into Luke, but only after Luke has been given the ball, where he's a pivot. So he gets a ball up high. He's just holding up high. Harper runs towards him and gets his defender picked off from Luke and then immediately dives toward the basket, at which time Luke just gives him a nice, easy pass, and then he has an easy throwdown, does Harper, off of an assist from Luke. So great, absolutely great. And then we're going to go to, as I said, these picks sometimes being the change in the offense for Wimby. And you heard Castle, I think, in the first quarter, they talked to him. And he goes, you know, how about this early, inside close work by Wimby? And he goes, Castle says, you know, Wimby's the engine of our offense, especially when he touches the paint. And so it started early, but it continued. Because at first, before I watched it again, I wasn't sure if it didn't dry up. But in reality, they really did get the ball to him in, you know, down low, maybe not like paint feeds, but at least lobs or something like it, you know, passes that are close to lobs for a lob layup, or he gets fouled. That did happen throughout the game, so it's very impressive. But let's talk about how it happened. So first basket is a Fox paint to paint to Wimby. Remember I said we need more post to post, we need more paint to paint. And Wimby stayed down on the baseline after basically trailing Castle, who probed the paint and passed out of it. Okay, so this is a Fox paint to paint. But what happened is Castle probes the paint. He goes toward the basket probing the paint. And when that's happening, because Castle is the one getting some of the attention, okay, as soon as Castle is the one getting the attention, as opposed to a straight-up, stationary, poor Wimby pick and roll, well, as soon as he picks and rolls off of there, the guy is just switching, potentially. I forget if it's switching. And then if the defender switched. But the point is then Wimby is picking off a traditional pick and roll. And because of that, they switched the defender, or it's his original defender, and he's still behind him with him in mind, because the guard that got pick and rolled, you know, is still not offering pressure towards the basket yet. He's gone lateral. And again, the lateral pick and rolls are not working. But in this case, this wasn't quite that. And because of that, Castle is drawing attention. He doesn't even keep the attention, but he's drawing the attention. And what Wimby's doing is paralleling that movement towards the basket. as soon as somebody else is going toward the basket, in this case, Castle, as soon as he gets those guys looking at him, Wimby's taking that advantage of the less focus on him, and he's going toward the basket in parallel while people aren't focusing on him. And so Castle passes out of it, but then it's to Fox, who then does a paint-to-paint to Wimby off of this. The very second basket is similar, as a defense is focused on Castle, who dribbles left to right, past the top of the free throw circle. Wimby rolls again to the basket off of an, if you will, an aura pick. So this is not that this is a really, where this is similar, is what I'll say. Castle's not even that close, okay? But Wimby goes, this is before the roll, the pick has really happened. And so I'm just going to take advantage of the lack of focus on me, because actually Castle's still really far away, and he starts to roll. And it's more, I'll say, off of an aura pick, a zone pick. It's not a pick in any sense, but it looks kind of like a zone pick. And so while that pressure is away from him, because Castle still has the ball, and so there's still more of a focus, like it's not an official pick and roll, so the defenders aren't quite thinking that way. Wimby just rolls again, takes advantage of the lack of focus and less congestion, and gets another lob. And another one, about 7:30, I forget what quarter, maybe first. It's a semi-pick to the outside for Castle, but as he attacks, Wimby comes down in parallel. This is one that Castle finished, but the idea is the same. Castle is taking attention, so Wimby is getting downhill while it's less congested. And when there is a, quote, pick, and Castle just goes laterally, that lack of congestion is not often the case. So, and I can't remember if this is one of them. The one that's really working, and I'll talk about this next one. I can't remember. I think it's this very next one. What's really working is a very, very high pick. And what it is really more of, instead of a perimeter, around the perimeter, three-point line pick, it is the guard is up high, higher than the three-point line. And so Wimby is now creating a pick. And the guard's not even yet on the three-point line to even consider going laterally. Instead, this is going to be a pick that's more of a triangular pick. It's more of a downhill pick. It is not a lateral pick. He's still got the ball a stride, 2-3, away from the three-point line. And Wimby's just right at the three-point line and gets himself directly behind the guard's defender, okay, in between the defender and the basket. And so now what the guard does is just make a triangular decision, the offensive guard. He goes left, he goes right. This still creates a potential switch, okay? And what happens, I forget if it's always that they're going under, is because Wimby just picked the guy vertically, if you will. Now, sometimes, or I think frequently as I saw it, usually the big guy who's guarding Wimby goes under to the guard that's getting this triangular pick really far up high, so that somebody's guarding him. He's making a choice. Well, now guess what? That defender who was behind Wimby is now with the guard. Where is Wimby now? He's up high-ish with the defender who is defending the guard up court from him. Okay? Up court from him. So the immediate defender right behind Wimby is now gone. This worked over and over again. So let's see here. Yeah. Sometimes, though, Wimby, we'll get back to the other one, is that he just quickly got behind everyone as the ball was coming up. So he just got behind Shamet, who was fronting him. And otherwise, the nearest defender is just Brunson. So he just got to purposely look for that. Get down everybody who might be front. Get past everybody who might be fronting you. Okay? So he's got Shamet, who's fronting him, and he's got Brunson. And this might be how they're trying to hide Brunson. You know, maybe he can just help defend, or he can get over to the three-point corner shooter. Shamet was, quote, fronting him. And Castle lobs a pass from actually beyond the three. And the offensive play is blocked, but after he gets to the pass. But the idea is good. That's another example. Sometimes it's not even that really lob play. It's just that he drifts towards deep position just because no one is bodying up the whole time. He's looking for that lack of congestion. That's what we're looking for. Not everybody is close to you all the time. You can go find where you can flow down to the paint. You truly, truly can. No, it's no chance that someone's bodying you up all the time, especially as the ball is still moving a little bit early in the clock. So find your inner Steph, Wimby. And I don't mean Castle, though that's great too. What's your inner Steph? Let me keep moving. Let me see where I can probe for how to flow towards where I want to flow. So find your inner Steph, Wimby. But we had many of these. This is a pseudo pick at the top of a court. And more than once, it was out of media break. So I think this was, let's see if this was, maybe it was second quarter. I said play off a media break at 3:30. So I believe it was second quarter. It's a small pseudo pick is what I'll call it at the top of the court after Fox has brought the ball up. As I was saying, Wimby is really just picking from the basket side way up high, not the lateral side, of the defender Bridges, who is on Fox. Therefore, he already has the leverage towards the basket as he's down court of Bridges. So as long as that action by Fox is mostly vertical in that, you know, triangular UFO, what do you call those? As long as that action is triangular and not lateral, then the defender on Wimby ends up switching usually. And Wimby has that lone defender, in this case, Mikal Bridges, on the upcourt side of him. And because he is, all he does then, as soon as the big man defender switches over to Fox, is just go to the hoop. Okay? He already has leverage towards the basket. If the defender switch, they do. OG squares up on Fox on the drop. As Fox turns a corner and starts to head toward the basket, Wimby does too, and then it's an alley-oop. A similar attempt after a media timeout, about 6:15 in the third. Lob is not successful, but they got the follow-up of their own miss. That time, we got one of those vertical, if you will, triangular picks by Vassell up top, so he could dive to the basket to the left. Just more deliberate also then about getting alone early towards the basket. Castle's barely over half court, having been pressed and trapped, so while the defense is still very expanded, Wimby just dives toward basket and gets a long pass for an easy layup. And maybe the one I talked about earlier, I may have double notes on that. Another first play, second half. Wimby sets a vertical pick way up high, therefore has a defender on his away from basket side, dives to the basket for an easy foul on a catch attempt. So sometimes it's just for a foul, but you get down there, that's what you get. In the second half, again, Fox peels off this vertical triangular pickup high, if you will. So Towns picks him up. Anunoby is on Wimby, but up court on him, so behind him. Fox goes vertical down a pace or two, as Wimby does too. So it's for a contested but successful layup. Okay, other aspects of this. I just thought that was huge. Again, easy ways to get to 7'5", the ball a little bit closer, because honestly, his perimeter play has not been effective. We'll talk about that, one of the miscellaneous things that maybe an action you've never seen by anybody that big, but not in a good way. We'll talk about that. I do think it's very interesting, and this is actually a factor. The president visited, and I don't think it's getting a lot of play in the normal media, but one of the guys who was in person at Pounding the Rock, wondered, and I think he was in person, but he talked to his compadre at the sister site. And you may have heard Castle go, "It's loud in here, but we're communicating, we're rotating." You know, Jeter was there, Eli, so many celebrities. DJ Khaled, I believe, was front seat too, if I saw it right. But so the Pounding of the Rock guy talks to the sister site guy, and he goes, "I got to say, I think the Trump thing affected things because we had so much more security and we just weren't as loud as usual. Part of it being they're exhausted, like the security took that much more." So that's interesting. I don't know how much that's true, but to the extent it's hard enough to take the second away game from a very good team, it's going to be harder. I expect the Garden to be much louder because presumably, "Hey, Trump, can you come visit again?" So I think another interesting factor, other people have talked about it, but I'll mention it briefly, is that full court pressure, at least pseudo pressure, on the New York guards. So they do get across half court at more like 18 or 17, don't have as much time to work. I think the Wemby closeouts were still a little reckless, or I thought that at first. Upon looking that, I'm not so sure that they were, but it does seem that multiple people got around him again on a closeout, and they may have been just because they had great moves, OG, some other ones. And I think he needs to understand, but I'm not blaming him in any one case. I may be overstating this as far as how often it happens. He needs to understand that he doesn't need to close out as hard. So know your defender, offensive player that you're defending, because he may not know them. Like he may be trying to close out in a neutral position. And I'm just thinking, I'm remembering, but not sure, that OG is beat him to the left, like, you know, kind of like how defenders in the NFL need to know where the guy's favorite move is, or, you know, where an offensive guard's move is. You got to think of where that guy's favorite move is as you close out. So I think it might be that OG likes to close to the left and Wemby is closing in a neutral fashion. Maybe he's not closing too hard, but I would close slower if I were 7'5". That's my initial impression. I'm not 100% sure. But I do think it's possible that Wemby still closes a little too hard for someone that tall. Keldon Johnson, not so much a good game, but at least effective minutes where it seemed more like Keldon and more of his brand of game. Granted, he missed like 3 out of 4 free throws. But he was used a little bit, got more minutes, I believe, in this game than usual. This did catch my eye just because this is more miscellaneous, just because I thought it was cool and noteworthy of everything we know, of what we already know, but in a specific sense, Wemby just being a different animal defensively. Steve Nash was a multiple-time MVP as a guard because he had that handle, that just awesome probe from one baseline all the way underneath the basket, all of a sudden come out of there like he's coming out of a tunnel. And he would decide. He would be under control. One time, Brunson does this later in the game from the right baseline. And you can see that Wimby's with him a little bit. And, you know, as Brunson kind of comes out that tunnel on the other side of the layup, against a lot of people, I think he'd do that reverse layup and think he had just enough time because he's tricky with his timing. But Wemby is nearby, and he goes, "I'm just going to come out of here." And, you know, he shoots out to the three-point line. And just, I think that happens a lot more. I mean, we know it does, right? I just imagine that in that instance, he would have tried that on somebody else. And just another good example of the power of Wemby defensively. Other Knicks thoughts. Brunson still semi went off in the fourth. He was 4 of 7 in the fourth, versus 7 for 27 for the entire Knicks team. So the Knicks not named Brunson only went 3 for 24 in the fourth, if I looked at that right. They did use Clarkson more. I thought that was interesting. We'll see how that goes. OG is always kind of laying there as a potential monster for the other team, and it is appearing, right? He comes down on the brakes. He gets lateral leverage on a defender. Look out, right? Similarly, when he gets somebody closing out of him, not just Wimby, someone else tried to do that, and he can see that lateral leverage and get past him for the dunk. Hart has the, so far, odd for the finals at least, good offensive night. So we'll see whether that's a one-off, but that's going to be interesting, right? Did you just go back to the, well, you see it a little bit in the stats, but some of his influence is not in the stats, but he's still very valuable, even though some are, like his offensive rebounding. You know, does Hart show again offensively? Knicks early turnovers, and generally the turnovers hurt him. Miscellaneous, I'll say, this is the last little bit here. Brown's comments on the free throws, it's not spilt milk, but it's a little bit. It's leaning toward the spilk, the milk, nearly coming out, or just a couple drops coming out. Not spilt milk, but multiple quarters, I believe, Spurs got into the bonus early. It's not, he said something like, you know, for all these shots that we made, you're telling me we only got, well, bro, some of those were because they got into the bonus early. It wasn't just because they were in the shooting motion, right? Yeah, the hammer by Castle on Brunson at 2:59. Yeah, I see how technically it wasn't a flagrant because there was no windup, there was no impact, there was no follow through. I do tend to agree with Legler in that it was more like an offensive player coming downhill and just running into you outside of the restricted zone. But he did not extend his arms. Like, he just kept his kind of elbow out, like you're going to just he did not extend his arms. But yeah, it's like that was definitely a foul, and I can see why people are upset. But I agreed with the rules as is. It's not a flagrant. They did search at it. This is a weird thing that Wimby has done multiple times, and I'm not sure I've seen any other large guy do it, let alone someone this large. I say he's still a little scared of Cat as a defender on him. He's still a little shook as far as that. But I guess if you say a little shook, you're not shook. But he's a little bothered. Wimby multiple times. That's why I say he's just not good at the perimeter. The walk-up three is better for him. He'll do this sometimes, even try to do crossover type of a dribble, but it's just not working. His attempts out at the perimeter, for the most part, when he has the ball in isolation, he properly is giving them up. But this is the example of, if you will, his hesitation. You saw two guys, two times in a row, literally twice in a row on the same possession early in the third quarter. This odd thing where Wimby is out on the perimeter for isolation. Cat's on him, and he goes up in the air for a three-ish, or he thinks, I don't know if he's giving up late, or that's his example of out on the perimeter, I'll go up for a three and then pass it to a perimeter guy, and that's his fake. But he did it twice. He did it twice in the same possession early in the third quarter, and then once under two, but to Castle, who drains a three. So that actually helped. So he's doing that a lot. He's like jumping for the jump shot, but then doesn't take the jump shot. And you think out at three at 7'5", you're either going to do that or not. So I don't know if that's just his hesitation. It was not entirely ineffective, but it's just the oddest thing. Let's see, what point was I making here? The subbing someone out at 5:23, hoping to get a chance to decide whether the ball went off of Brunson or not, was weird, but they're allowing them to do that. But it is lucky that Harper didn't get called and that he just went right on the court. So lucky that way. Let's see what here. Oh, Carter Bryant, the rookie whistle just is hilarious to me. I'm just pointing it out, not because it doesn't happen to Knicks rookies, because it does. But he gets rebound position at the side of the paint about halfway up the left line because the ball's going up. And then Cat just dives from the top of the key. And because Carter just sets his hip as he's looking at the basket, and then Cat just runs into the side of him and tumbles and gets a call. It's a foul, and it's a quick foul on Carter Bryant. That's just like, well, you're a rookie, and you therefore you fouled. Just odd. But that's the way of the NBA. They're just weird that way. And the big thing for the next game, I think, is, you know, how do they adjust to this, if you will, triangular pick? And if they adjust, and I don't know what that adjustment is, because I think it's a great pick. I think it's awesome. I think it's key. But if they adjust the Knicks somehow, how do the Spurs adjust to get them off of Wimby and for Wimby to go, yeah, but still look how to flow when there's not a rock in your way, it's going to be somewhere. Flow toward the basket so you're available for putbacks. You're available for close-in lobs. You're available for paint to paint. You've got to have that in your mindset. It's not just a pick and roll and they bump you on the way down after a bad lateral pick and roll. And if they do, you're just kind of token looking for it. Okay. If they have an answer for this triangular vertical pick and roll that the Spurs have run way up high, then what is your adjustment for that? And I think it's very interesting. You know, it's anybody's ball game. This is a heavyweight fight. And can the Spurs stay in it such that they don't, that it's at least close, you know, in the fourth quarter? On the one hand, everything says they will, but on the other hand, it's just brewing for an inevitable NBA since 2016. Somebody runs away with it because they get hot from the three, right? They get hot, they get home court momentum, things change, just can't get backed into it. Now, the Spurs have shown that against the Thunder, that they're less likely once it comes to it to just like succumb to, you know, a 10-point lead becomes a 20-point lead. And now it's just a runaway freight train. And do you consider resting in the fourth? So, no, that's not a thing necessarily for the Spurs late, but it has been a thing. I mean, they've rested in the fourth in this playoffs. So it's going to be really interesting to see if the Spurs can avoid that type of game where the Knicks are going, we're going to get momentum early. We're going to run away with this. The crowd's going to be behind us. Everybody's going to be hitting from three because we're playing at home. But I still think the best bet is to, I like it, but I could be wrong because we won the game. I like the idea that Wimby doesn't guard anybody per se. He stays on that away baseline so he can see still in the paint to give people something to think about or on the edge of the paint. If it does go away on the far corner, he has a little bit of time to adjust, and we'll let that guy get threes as opposed to giving up the intimidation factor of Wimby not being in the paint because he's way out on the perimeter guarding Cat. So the adjustments are like, really, remember that Wimby famously, when he was in New York, he said, "Who wants to play chess?" And this is chess, bro. This is chess in New York. And tonight's for all the marbles. Not because it wins anything, but because it makes things possible for the Spurs, and it makes it all but done for if the Knicks can win. So it's just short of all for the marbles. As Regan says, no, it's not a must-win game. I can lose this one. It's once I can't lose anymore, Brian Regan. Find his bit. No. Well, no, we can lose this game. See, if we do, we're not out of the series because they have to win four, and then we have only won three. But it's just short of that. It's not for all the marbles, but the marble jar is starting to be slid over in the direction of the Knicks if they win. So, yeah, super, super interesting game. Going to be amazing. All right, guys, thanks for listening to Scales of Truth. I'm Tyson Harley.